I'm Don Luck, and I teach systematic theology at Trinity Lutheran Seminary in Columbus, Ohio. There is a Lutheran seminary east of the Mississippi. I'm here to represent that fact. In fact, there are even more than one. But I just want to say how happy I am to be here. It's been a dream of mine to be at Holden for many, many years. For 13 years, I taught in the religion department at Concordia College in Moorhead, Minnesota. So I hear more than one or two or three of you here are from Minnesota. I keep hearing rumors to that effect. So I'm very happy to be here after a long last, after this being a dream of mine for some time. Let me outline for you a little bit what we will be doing, or I will be doing anyway, over the next several days. And the overall title that I have for the series is Christian Response in an Uncertain America. And my basic thesis is that the social glue that has held America together and given it a sense of coherence and provided people with a sense of certainty has become unstuck, and that there is a lot of free-floating uncertainty around in our society. And in this particular context, there are two very powerful, important, and attractive temptations for people. The one is a move toward forms of authoritarianism and unquestioned certainty, and the other is a drift into a kind of privatism where if you can't trust anybody outside of yourself, if there seem to be no objective certainties or authorities, then it's best to sort of create your own reality and create your own world and be your own authority. And so that there's a drift toward a kind of privatism. And I think these are the two great temptations facing our society at this time. Now, in this regard, I don't pretend to give you a total profile of American society. I'm not being that presumptuous. Nor do I think that this is the only way you can think about a religious profile of America. But I do think that it is an important element of the life of the American people, and it has direct relevance to the life of religion in America. And therefore, it is very significant in its effect upon the churches. And that's what I would like to have us think about together in these coming days. Today, I intend to provide a sort of overview to what I see as the basic problem that I'm trying to sketch out for us here, calling it An America Come Unglued. Three other sessions this week and then four sessions next week, I'll try to explore particular elements within that. Tomorrow, looking at America as what I call a social security system, and by that I don't mean something that happens to you after you retire and you get a check in the mail, but how a society, a cohesive community, such as a nation, provides a certain kind of social security for people, and what that means when that security system begins to break down, and free-floating anxiety begins to emerge. And we're going to really look more at the whole business of where this anxiety comes from. Tomorrow is the human hunger for security. I'm sorry, I'm not even keeping track of myself. How can I expect you to do that if I can't do it myself? The human hunger for security, and then America is a social security system. And then finally on Saturday, some dimensions of authority, looking at what is authority, what makes authority an authority. And then next week, looking at the two temptations, one, the temptation, the lure of religious absolutism or authoritarianism, and then next, what I call sampling the religious smorgasbord, privatism. And then talking about what I understand to be the implications of the gospel. The gospel as embracing uncertainty, and secondly, the gospel as, and here's a phrase from Martin Marty that I borrowed, the gospel as convinced openness. convinced openness. And so that's what I'd like to explore in these coming sessions. But to begin today, just to sort of chart what I see happening, I'd like to utilize a few lines from a poem by W.B. Yeats that he wrote in 1920 to 21, following the First World War and its spiritual, psychological, social effects upon Europe, a poem entitled The Second Coming, in which he writes, "Things fall apart, the center cannot hold, mere anarchy is loosed upon the world. The blood-dimmed tide is loosed, and everywhere the ceremony of innocence is drowned. The best lack all conviction, while the worst are full of passionate intensity." I think that's an incredible profile of what was happening in Europe following the First World War, and I want to suggest that it reflects something of what is happening to us following the breakdown of our own self-confidence in a series of powerful events that really have shaken the psyche of this nation. I refer to the civil rights struggle and the unmasking of supposed American innocence, the further unmasking of that innocence in the Vietnam War, and then the even further unmasking of that innocence in the closing days of the Nixon presidency. And I think that the cumulative effect of those events is such that in many respects, although it's not exactly the same, we are in a parallel situation to where Europeans, especially continental Europeans, found themselves following the First World War. Things do seem to be falling apart, and I'm dealing here not necessarily with objective facts, but with significant perceptions on the part of people. What really matters at this point is what people assume is happening, what they feel is happening. Whether in fact that is happening or not is almost besides the point, because the motivation behind people's lives very often lies in their perceptions and their assumptions, not necessarily in the facts of the case. Now, the turbulence that people sense all around them and sometimes within them is not unparalleled. Every culture, every society, and every age experiences uncertainty and turbulence and change. And this is especially true in the West, which almost seems to be addicted to change. Denis de Rougemont argues that Westerners feel perennially that they are in a state of crisis. I mean, the word is almost overused now to the point of being trite or exhausting. What, another crisis? You know, we have the energy crisis, we have the environmental crisis, we have all sorts of crises. That almost seems to be Western in character, that Westerners are always living on the edge of crisis. But nevertheless, it seems as if in American society today, there is a heightened sense of crisis that is associated with a sense of rapid, far-reaching, and troubling change. This turbulence is not due to one single cause. Human beings and human communities are very complex, so I'm just taking a particular reading and not arguing that I have all wisdom on the matter, or that my taking the psychological, spiritual temperature of the United States tells you about America and all of its parts. This reminds me of a story that Carl Broughton once told here at Holden Village about his own experience when he was a graduate student at the University of Heidelberg and he came down with the flu. And he went to a nearby clinic and was ushered in to see the doctor. And the doctor said that he would have to take Broughton's temperature. And of course, Broughton thought it was superfluous since he already knew that he was sick. But nevertheless, he was handed this rather large thermometer, and the doctor left the room. And Broughton promptly administered the thermometer by opening his mouth and sticking it on his tongue and taking his temperature. And then after a period of time, took it out of his mouth, and the doctor walked in, and the doctor looked at him with horror as he saw this thermometer seemingly coming out of Broughton's mouth. And he said, "Mein Gott! You didn't put that in your mouth, did you?" And a horrible thought began to cross Broughton's mind about this. And he said, "Well, where did you expect me to put it?" And the doctor said, "Well, that's not how we take temperatures here in Germany." With that, promptly took the thermometer and administered it as it should be, namely sticking it under his arm. So you see, there's more than one way to go about analysis, you see. So as I said, I'm not claiming all wisdom, but I would like to have us think about something of this turbulence. In the past, Americans have generally welcomed change. Across the board, speaking broadly, Americans have welcomed change. Perhaps that's because we generally are a society of people who have been uprooted and moved to a new country, and most who have come here willingly and gladly, seeking creative change, looking for new beginnings. And we have a powerful frontier mythos, a basic mythological structure that informs who we are. And we see ourselves in terms of a frontier or a horizon, and we always are moving toward that horizon. But what enabled us to embrace change and to look forward to possibilities beyond what have been realized was a sense that all this took place within a stable pattern. There was a stable pattern of progress, that all of these changes were ultimately for the good, and that they had a positive cumulative effect, and that all of these changes took place within a framework of enduring values. I mean, the basic values of the society were in place, and it was only really change in terms of spelling out the implications or the further unfolding of those values. But the values themselves were stable and predictable, and the source of a certain amount of stability and security. But what has been happening is that change has been coming at an incredible rate, and some of you perhaps are familiar with Alvin Toffler's work, The Third Wave and Future Shock and the like, in which he spells out the incredible rapidity of change and the large degree of change. Many, many things seem to have been changing in the last several decades, and that has created a sense of uneasiness and uncertainty and disruption. What is happening is that there is increasingly a sense that a social coherence, a sense of a solidarity, an American solidarity, and a kind of coherent American identity is being fragmented. And we're agreeing less and less on more and more. And basic patterns of living are even shifting around. Just think, I'm sure you can think of an example. I mean, one of the most obvious examples that comes to mind for me right now is the breakdown of the family farm. I mean, we're really beginning to have to face the possibility that that whole pattern of life may go. It just may be gone. What happens then? I mean, just think of that change, that sea change. Small town America. What, you know, the whole a major element of our collective memory and a pattern of life that is very, very indigenous to us, just disappears. So it's that sense. Or think of the incredible changes that are associated with the emergence of the women's movement, where women are coming to struggle with issues that they never dreamed that they would ever see as issues at all. I mean, like, who am I anyway? What does it mean to be a woman? What is my role? Here I am, wife and mother, and yet what about financial and vocational independence, just like a male? And what is the character of being a woman? Are women supposed to be more gentle, more tolerant, more dependent, more flexible than males are? And suddenly what is happening is that that women are becoming very confused about the whole notion of what it means to be a woman, and there's less and less unquestioned assumption about these things. That's the point. Suddenly, things that were not questioned before, that were just working assumptions, now suddenly are up for grabs. Or think of patriotic appreciation of American achievements and American values. Think of President Eisenhower's statement, "America is great because America is good." Well, we know that we're not as good as we used to think we were, and we're wondering about just how great we really are. And the clash of American with American over that sort of question. Traditional values coming up for grabs. What in fact happened in generations past isn't the question, but the assumptions about sexual morality. I mean, that there was cohesive public condemnation of premarital and extramarital sex. Whether in fact that happened or not, that's not the point. The point is that the value was in place. And if those things happened, they were obviously outside the ballpark. You know, foul line. You crossed the foul line. And everyone would scream foul. And now it's so much taken for granted that it's part and parcel of soapbox stuff on TV. Not only a TV drama, even TV comedy, you know, Three's Company and all that. That's just an operating assumption. Or the same, consider divorce. Just one generation ago, divorce was something that happened to very wealthy people or Hollywood movie stars or, you know, somebody's third cousin who lives somewhere remotely in way off someplace, hardly even heard about. Now, there's probably hardly a family in the United States that somewhere within its orbit there isn't divorce. Think of your own family circle. Think of your own circle of friends and neighbors. And are there any here where divorce is not present? I don't see a single hand. That's an incredible change. Now, this is not simply to say that in the past, therefore, marriage was more healthy or more wonderful. It might have been that a lot of marriages that should not have continued were continuing. We're not looking at that. We're looking at the sheer givenness of these radical changes in fundamental operating assumptions in our country, in our nation. And with these shifts, with these changes, comes an increased sense of uncertainty. Now, this is not to say that the past was as tranquil or homogeneous or coherent as certain romantics of the past would have us believe. America always has been a community of communities. Not everybody bought into the basic values or the basic assumptions, and not everything that one would assume about America fits under the rubric of Mom, Apple Pie, 4th of July, and Norman Rockwell's Saturday Evening Post covers. I mean, check out subcultures. Ask the Native American population how they would view the history of the United States. Ask the black community how it would view the history of the United States. You get a very different sort of reading. Or even some of the basic assumptions about how to think about things. It caused the Roman Catholic Church to create its own alternative school system to the public school system of the United States because it did not want its young people being inculcated with the basic operating assumptions of the Protestant majority. So I'm not trying to suggest that America was marvelously coherent or cohesive, but generally speaking, there was an operating sense of assumptions that were in place that we sort of relied upon and took comfort from and gave us a sense of identity and direction and a certain basic sense of certainty and security. And what has been happening is that these things have been falling apart. Things fall apart, the center cannot hold. And in the minds of some, to again quote the words of Yeats, it seems as if mere anarchy is loosed upon the world. Now, moving to the second kind of reflection this afternoon. When times get turbulent and life becomes uncertain, people very often turn to their religious communities and institutions and traditions for a sense of anchoring. You know, the storms of life rage all around us, but we are in the ark, and the ark has a strong and eternal anchor. And there we find serenity, and there we can find some sense of reassurance and direction. Because religious communities are witnesses to and representatives of that which is eternal, that which is permanent and unchanging, that which is beyond flux. And so the churches represent the eternal and final, the ultimate framework within which we live out our lives. And so it is, whenever times get tough or turbulent and there's confusion and uncertainty, people turn to their religious communities for that reassurance and that kind of serenity and sense of permanency. But what has been happening in a very powerful way since the mid-60s is that the mainline churches in America increasingly have reflected and expressed the very turbulence and change that the society has experienced. So, you know, the world is coming apart, the sense of direction is unclear. You go to the church and this, you know, your ethnic congregation, pick your ethos, you know, Polish, Irish, Norwegian, Swedish, or whatever. And the black female pastor is talking about homosexual rights and leading the worship out of the new green book that throws everything up in the air again. You know, where can you go to find, people were singing last night, that old-time religion that gives you that old-time certainty about old-time things and that old-time world with that old-time God? Everything seems up for grabs, even within the churches. Take, for example, the whole business of the women's movement. We now have women pastors. This is an incredible change. This is a radical departure from almost 20 centuries of clearly delineated, unchallenged tradition. Now, there are some scholars running around today who argue that the first century church had women leaders within it. But it's interesting that they argue this only now. How come biblical scholars didn't see it in 1940 or in 1840? How come Martin Luther was devoted to the Bible, he read the Bible, committed, said everything depends on the Bible, we've got to really be saturated in biblical thinking. How come he didn't come to the conclusion that the first century had women pastors? But suddenly we can reach that conclusion today. Why? Because our consciousness has been changed. Because our sensibilities have been affected. By what? Biblical scholarship? Are you kidding? It was affected by the women's movement, the secular women's movement. That's why we have women pastors today. That's the fundamental reason. The women's movement in the United States and elsewhere throughout the world stimulated the life of the church and the leadership of the church to do some hard thinking and begin to re-examine the tradition. And it even began to have biblical scholars begin to see strange things in strange places. And lo and behold, we not only have women pastors, we have an apologetic that this is biblically coherent. Rather interesting argument when it was not evident all of these centuries. So you see what is happening. The turbulence, the uncertainty, the confusions, the changes are entering into the churches themselves. I think perhaps the most classic example of this is the Roman Catholic Church. See, what's interesting here is that these changes are taking place not just in some quiet little corner of some exotic liberal churches, you know, the Unitarians. I mean, everything is up for grabs in Unitarianism. I mean, that's the whole definition of what a Unitarian is. It once was said that Unitarians are those who believe, notice the sexist term, in the fatherhood of God, the brotherhood of man, and the neighborhood of Boston. I mean, that's what they used to say. But you know, now it's wide, everything's wide open. I mean, they're not even limited to Boston. I mean, this is a whole new ballgame there. Now, we wouldn't be surprised if that was true for Unitarians, but now, or even maybe some Methodists, you know. Methodists had women pastors in some of the earlier decades of this century. But now, I mean, and now it's the so-called mainline conservative traditional churches, those who have a conscious memory of their past and have a sense of coherence and continuity with the past. You know, Anglicans, Lutherans, and Roman Catholics. Now, it's not to say that everywhere there's joyful enthusiasm about these changes, on the contrary, but it is to say that the changes are taking place in these self-consciously traditional churches, and I think the case in point is the Roman Catholic Church since Vatican II. You know, Pope John the 23rd said we need some aggiornamento, some updating, and so we ought to open the windows of the church and let a little fresh air. Well, he didn't realize that he was letting loose a whirlwind. And now everything is swirling around. And there's a lot of confusion and a lot of tension. And those of you up here in the Pacific Northwest know about that, and Bishop Hunthausen and all the rest, and all that is happening, has been happening in regard to his administration of his diocese. There is turbulence wherever we turn, including within the churches themselves. But then on top of it, now we have the notion that not only is the church the arena within which these changes take place, the church is called upon to be a change agent. You know, that the church ought to be deeply involved as the leaven of the loaf, involved in bringing about creative positive change. And the mainline churches and liberal churches were very much calling out for all Christians to do this. And now we have the moral majority responding, and there are some liberal Christians who are saying, foul, foul. But moral majority types are only doing what the liberal churches have been calling upon all Christians to do all along, namely get politically involved. It's just that they have a different agenda. See? And now we have the business of the churches being involved as change agents. And in this regard, the mainline churches seem at times, this is again impression, seem at times simply to be a reflection of some of the latest new waves of change within the society, and they sort of endorse it and legitimate it and popularize it or communicate it. And there are many people who are upset about this. And the mainline churches seem to, again the impression, seem to believe less and less, or they believe what they believe with less and less certainty. I mean, the sharp, clear divisions between things no longer is in place. I remember I was confirmed in the Missouri Synod way back when, and part of our catechetical instruction was looking at the clear teachings of the Lutheran Church, its biblical foundations, and all the unbiblical, heretical distortions of the Roman Catholic Church. You know, and it was very clear. Well, you know, those sorts of clear distinctions are just sort of breaking down. And now Lutherans feel, certain Lutherans feel more comfortable with certain Roman Catholics than they do with their own fellow Lutherans. And same with Roman Catholics. I mean, the question is, don't you people know what you believe anymore? You know, where are the churches that know what they believe? Where's certainty around here? Where do we have some certainty? And where do we have some certainty about moral issues? What about abortion? What about homosexuality? What about divorce? We want some clear guidance here. And you churches seem to be talking out of both sides of your mouth. Where are the churches that really know what they believe? And so what we are experiencing here is a crisis of authority. What we're discovering is that the authorities that are around are being relativized. They no longer have a kind of absolute character about them. Now, when we talk about an absolute, what do we mean? And notice how it's very similar to the word absolve. That which is absolute is absolved. Absolved from what? From limitation, from qualification. Everything else can be qualified and is, in fact, limited. Those things are relative. But the absolute is absolved from such qualification. Well, that's how we look to religious authority and moral authority. And it looks as if now what's happening is the absolute character of these authorities is being undermined and it's being revised. And therefore, they no longer, these religious certainties, no longer are that unqualified, and therefore they cannot provide an unqualified security. People discover that they turn to the church for affirmation and direction and a sense of certainty, and it is not forthcoming. And therefore their own personal, psychological, spiritual sense of uncertainty is heightened. So it even has gotten to the point in terms of authority that not only do we find old authorities being challenged in the name of the new or in the name of change, but there really now is a growing sense on the part of some in our society whether there is any authority at all. And I think that that is perhaps the most important development in our society. And the development that I think is most parallel to what happened in Europe, especially in Germany, in Weimar Republic Germany following the First World War. The rise of a considerable number of people in our society who really doubt whether there is any objective given authority that really is there outside of themselves, and therefore they turn to themselves for their own self-direction and their own moral and religious guidance. Perhaps the most compelling and interesting analysis of this in American culture is a book that I heartily recommend to you. It's a sociological profile of the United States developed by a group of sociologists at University of California in Berkeley, headed by Robert Bella. And the book is published under Robert Bella's name, B-E-L-L-A-H, Habits of the Heart. Perhaps some of you are familiar with this book. But the subtitle of the book is Individualism and Commitment in American Life. And the argument is that we are drifting more and more toward a kind of individualism, a kind of privatism, in which people increasingly are withdrawing into their own private realities and their own separate realities. There's an example in here for of one woman whose name is Sheila, who talks about that, you know, what is her philosophy of life, what is her religion? She calls it Sheilaism. And it's very much reflective of two important themes that emerged out of the countercultural movement back in the mid-60s and into the 70s. The first was don't trust anyone over 40. Remember that? Don't trust authorities. Question the system, that whole motif. And the other one, which is even more powerful and more important, is the phrase, do your own thing. Bella and the other sociologists argue that if we think the countercultural movement has disappeared and has failed, on the contrary, it has succeeded in a very powerful and important way, precisely in making these notions about questioning any authority outside of oneself and trusting oneself really be basic to the formation of one's personal life. For a considerable group, a significant group of people in our culture. Yes?
What you're saying then is almost that countercultural movement, like Sheilaism, instead of from being a fringe movement essentially in the 60s and early 70s, has in fact become in a sense the mainstream.
I don't know how far I want to go in terms of numbers, but it is a significant force and voice within our culture today, operating in a very quiet way. It's not a kind of organized way or you know, obvious slogans. But one of the interesting things is, and that is a contrast from the countercultural movement, is that it tends to be apolitical. You withdraw from politics. You withdraw into your own self-realization and so forth. The sort of thing talked about by Christopher Lash in his analysis of the culture of narcissism. Yeah.
It might be interesting to note that Oliver North graduated from college about the same time that Sylvia did in 1968.
That who did?
Oliver North. He's a fellow that...
the same time, yes. The same time as whom?
As Sylvia in your book, in 1968.
Sheila, you mean. Sheila, I'm sorry. I didn't understand your term. Sheila. Yeah, see, that's the flip side. That's what I'm coming to. That's the other side. They're the two poles and the two powerful forces in our culture. And the question is, as Christians, is there an alternative to Sheilaism on the one side and Ollie North and company on the other? Or another way of putting it, what is the alternative? Or how does one sketch out the alternative between an unqualified relativism or privatism on the one hand and a drift toward authoritarianism and absolutism on the other? That's the course that I want to chart, which gets me right to my next subtopic, Scylla and Charybdis. In the ancient world, they used to talk about Scylla and Charybdis, there's no clear knowledge as to what they were talking about, but it was a navigational hazard, and the best guess is it was believed to lie between Italy and the island of Sicily in the so-called straits, in the Straits of Messina. And on the one hand was Scylla. Scylla was a rocky shoal. Actually, they even talked about a siren sitting on a rocky shoal, luring sailors over. And so you had this rocky shoal on the one side, and then Charybdis on the other was a tidal whirlpool. And ships would get caught up in the tidal whirlpool. And I'd like to use these as analogs for these two attractive temptations in our society today, that in a time of a perceived turbulence and uncertainty, when things seem to have come unglued, there are those who are attracted toward a Scylla-like approach to life. They want rock-sure certainty. And there's a certain kind of rigidity about things, and a sense that here is the truth, and we have a corner on reality, and we know where it all is, and that is the lure of authoritarianism. of absolutism. And it comes in many, many different forms. The most obvious examples, of course, are religious fundamentalism and political totalitarianism or political absolutism. But there also are other forms. The cults, in many ways, represent that because they look to the cult leader and to the cult system as a security system in which the individual merges and where the individual finds security. That is a very powerful temptation around for a lot of people. As I said, many different forms. The followers of the Ayatollah Khomeini represent this in an Islam that's becoming unglued with the impact of westernization and relativization and all the rest of it. That's a kind of, they call it Islamic fundamentalism, and there are many people who object to the term fundamentalism. But what I think it has in common with fundamentalism is this sense of absolute certainty and a kind of unquestioning commitment and a lack of self-criticism. That's the important point. A lack of self-criticism within the movement. I remember 1 week when I was teaching at Concordia College in Moorhead, I call it the week that was. You remember that TV program, the week that was? Well, this was my week that was. I had three separate conversations within the week. The one was with a fundamentalist student who had everything just tied down and who was resisting any kind of critical approach to anything and was always trying to find chapter and verse within the scriptures, you know, to sort of gift him that sense of solidity and certainty and clarity and the like. The second student was a follower of Ayn Rand in her philosophy of objectivism. Perhaps you know that. She talks about the virtue of selfishness and so forth, that be all that you can be, you know, don't give a rap about anybody else but yourself, develop your own potential, the hell with the rest of the world, and that's really, it's those kind of people that really are the great people in the world and really are the creators and those who really develop society. And along with it, a very strong apologetic for a kind of total freewheeling entrepreneurial capitalism. You know, there it all was, and he was busy arguing an epistemological point with me, and gave me this literature to read, and I read it. And the whole problem with the thing was that all the conclusions were built into all the assumptions in the beginning, and all the assumptions were open to question. And I tried to make this clear to the student, and he couldn't see it. Because he wouldn't see it. But this, it had all the answers for him. And the third apparition, I call it that, was suddenly there was this knock at the door, and I was working there on Friday afternoon, and in came this person. I had never seen the likes before in my life, at least and three-dimensionally. shaved head, peach-colored robe on and sneakers, and the Hare Krishna bus had come to town. He came in. I was fascinated. I knew nothing about this. I had never encountered anybody from a movement like that before. And so he wanted to chat. Fine, come in, sit down. And then he wanted to give me a copy of the Bhagavad Gita, and I told him I already had a copy. Oh, it wasn't the correct translation. It was not correct. It was not translated by a believer. This was the translation by Sri Prabhupada, you know, and therefore was the real thing. And so I was curious about their belief system and their assumptions, and I began asking questions, and he couldn't answer in a straightforward way. He would search around, and then he'd come up with a Sanskrit quote, and then translate it into English, and then would go off on his own merry path. And we never really had any genuine dialogue, because he was off doing his own thing. Well, time went on, and I suddenly looked back at that week, and if you plotted these people, I mean, if you had to develop a kind of visual chart to plot the differing belief systems of these three people, you'd have to draw an equilateral triangle. I mean, you couldn't get them far enough apart, you know? Atheism and objectivism and selfishness on the one hand and fundamentalist Christianity on the other, and, you know, the commitment to the teachings of the Bhagavad Gita as interpreted by Prabhupada in a kind of new form of Hinduism. You know, what do they have in common? I suddenly realized they were totally interchangeable. These three people were totally interchangeable. because what they had in common was this closed system where they had unqualified absolute authority, which they assumed and which they made impregnable by making it unquestionable, and everything unfolded from that, and out of this they found a sense of a coherence, direction, and certainty in life. So how do we avoid the Scylla of that kind of rigidity on the one hand, and then on the other hand, this kind of Scylaism, this kind of privatism, we're sampling the religious smorgasbord, having a little bit of this, a little bit of that, we sort of make it up as we go along. Self-actualization is really where it's all at. I become my own thing, I do my own thing, I am my own thing. The result of that is a lack of social coherence. We no longer, I mean, we become more and more isolated from one another. We just sort of pass along sampling of little goodies and we sort of pick and choose as we will, but there's no real coherence. There's no real community in that. And that is not very helpful either. Again, I think of something that came out of my college teaching experience. It was in the latter 60s, and occasionally you'd hear a sophomoric student say in some kind of discussion, "Well, that's your reality." And one of my colleagues developed a wonderful one-line response that I borrowed. He said, "Why bother to tell me about it?" I mean, isn't there some kind of a shared world? Isn't there something we really have in common? Isn't there some kind of pattern to life? Isn't there something into which we enter as human beings that we don't invent or make up as we go along? Are we not answerable to something larger than ourselves? See? Now, how then do we thread our way through Scylla and Charybdis, through this rock-like rigidity and this swirling whirlpool of undifferentiated relativism on the other? And how do we begin to chart an alternative, that is implicit within our understanding of the gospel? That's what I'm going to be up to in the next several days with you, reflecting about that. And this is, I've taken a fair amount of time here this afternoon just to kind of give you that broad overview. And now we'll look at it in more detail and maybe look at some assumptions, operating assumptions in my analysis along the way. Well, let me draw to a close at this point and open it up to you and your responses and your reflections and your questions. I wonder, am I reading something that you sense is out there too, or do you see evidences of this, or how do you respond, or where are your questions?
Are you familiar with Cities on a Hill?
No.
Recent, I can't think of who the author is, but it's an 86 or 87 publication. And in that, she charts the Rajneesh, the Falwells, Lynchburg, Virginia, the Castro, the gay community in San Francisco, and the retirement community in Florida, and does almost exactly that, sees the interchangeableness and the common characteristics among all of those, as diverse as they are, as communities, and it really fits in that same pattern very closely.
Cities on a Hill?
Cities on a Hill.
And the author?
Francis Fitzgerald.
Yeah.
It's first Francis published
Fitzgerald.
In New York.
Which is what, yeah. What did she write earlier? That was
Fire in the Lake.
Yeah.
It's a derivative analysis of the Puritan experience and an attempt to recreate.
Yeah. Yeah, there certainly are coherences and there are patterns. As I said, I'm painting with a very broad brush here, and I would qualify it all over the place. I mean, one of the common motifs is that America is a redemptive community. Or if America isn't the redemptive community, the subculture, the subgroup within America is the redemptive community. And there's a very quick identification between Yahweh and his covenantal relationship with Israel and God and his relationship with the United States or with this particular redemptive group. That is a major motif in the United States, that's right. But nevertheless, the fact that there are such differing interpretations of that. And what happens to that when it becomes Sheilaism? You don't have a redemptive community. You only have Sheila redeeming her own life by doing her own thing and developing herself on her own, by her own wits and so forth.
I've been reading this Light in the Darkness by Douglas John Hall, this study on towards an indigenous theology of the cross. And he, in analyzing American society, he shows how we've been an optimistic, positivistic society all along, and expecting a good end that you mentioned, you know, everything moving toward a perfect society. But that is no longer possible. And we negate, what we're doing is negating the fact that it is no longer possible. We refuse to see that. And are trying to hold on to this optimistic viewpoint. And then he says it's no longer possible because of the death of humanity. That a greater thing that's going to happen, that the Omega point, is new. And the question is, can man survive? But even a deeper question is, can humanity survive? Can men, who can perhaps survive and adapt, can they still be human? Or kind of get down to the animal level? Well, in all of this, he said that happened in the Second World War, at the Holocaust and so forth. That strikes me, if he's right, what you are saying, what you have presented here is really kind of evidences of what's going on in our society and the negation that we have of what we actually are facing and don't want to face up to.
I think, yes, what I heard you affirming very strongly was this analysis that Americans have tended to be optimistic and progressivistic, and that we have really tripped and stumbled in that, and it's a question of whether we can recoup that and whether we can maintain in the light of so many things, including, as you mentioned, something like the event of the Holocaust that the Jews have suffered and the threat of nuclear annihilation. That certainly really puts a fundamental question mark next to this assumption that every day and every way we're getting better and better and change is always for the good and so forth. It's like new improved tide, and you wonder, I wonder what was wrong with the old one, you know? Or we really wonder whether the new car is going to be better than the old one, you know, anymore. That notion that there is inevitable progress is certainly a major issue. And I think it underlies a lot of religious search in our own day, both on the part of authoritarians and relativists. The authoritarians looking, maybe giving up on America, and then looking for a new world, or thinking they have the political answer to make America really become the progressive city on the hill that it's supposed to be. Or on the other hand, the privatistic view, well, you can give up on the world, but you can at least improve yourself. And I think that's where there's a lot of that running around in American religion today.
It seems to me that at least one of the things that I've experienced, especially this last year teaching in greater Los Angeles area, is this question of authority seems to break down into two separate items. One is a definition of authority. Says authority is that which has the answers. And the other is authority is that which has the power. Whether it has the answers or not, it has the power. And a lot of the things fall apart problem and the crisis, the sense of instability comes from a sense of helplessness in dealing with the power. That sense of individual and corporate lack of ability to control what is happening. I think the change is wrong, but every time I try and do something, I can't do anything. In our church search Bible study, over and over again, one of the refrains that I heard was, yeah, things have to change, but we can't do it. It has to come from government, from them, from outside. And it was an expression of that same sense of helpless hopelessness. Am I making sense?
Yes, I think that's a very interesting observation, and I think it's a very helpful one for us here. That authority is not only the source of answers or direction, but it also is the embodiment and that which exercises power. And I think that that is, I think that's a very important observation. And it would be interesting to see how this can be developed when it'll be on Saturday that I want to take a look at some dimensions of authority. And it, that, I think, would be an important part of that reflection. I'd be interested in your contributions if you're going to be here. Well, maybe we have a chance to talk afterwards, and I'll try and share what you have to say with others on that day. Any closing comment or closing question? I was interested to note the number of heads that were nodding as I was describing some things and asking, is this coherent with your experience? And see a lot of yeah. I played a trick on a group of people the other month. I'm a theologian in residence at a Presbyterian church in Columbus this year, and we took a group up to the Stratford Festival in Ontario. And one of the plays we saw was Cabaret, and the other one was Bertolt Brecht's Mother Courage. And both are kind of interesting interrelationship, and both really bring to mind Weimar Republic Germany, the Germany of the 1920s into the early 30s and the rise of Hitler. And I read to them a passage. And I talked about the United States and how it had this great enthusiasm and optimism and growth and so forth following the Second World War, and went on through and then it self-doubt following the Vietnam War and so forth, and all the social symptoms that began to happen, youth culture, a lot of turbulence. There's a lot of creativity. When things become unglued, there's also a time of incredible creativity. Describe youth culture, or drug culture, interest in Eastern mysticism or Eastern religions and mysticism, and out of the body experience, occult, on and on and on. And neo-Marxism or Marxism and so forth, socialist movements, on and on and on. Spell out the whole thing and said, does this sound like the United States today? And they're all saying, yeah, yeah. And I said, I just read something written by Wilhelm Pauk, a book written in 1939, introducing the theology of Karl Barth to the American public, called Karl Barth, Prophet of a New Christianity? And all I did was just change the historical names from Franco-Prussian War to World War II, and World War I to Vietnam War, and so forth and so on. And there it was. Now, this isn't to say that everything is exactly the same, but there are some interesting correlations. And what I'm aware of is precisely the danger that the hunger for certainty posed for the German people, looking for certainty and stability, clear direction, a sense of national identity again. And there was Adolf Hitler and his friends ready and able to give them that. So think on those things. Thank you for coming.